A man who wears the 10 pounds of gold.
The nature boy, Ric Flair.
You know, I always like to take this opportunity to talk about myself. Woo!
Woo! The 16-time heavyweight champion has arrived.
I've got the style and profile like never before.
The greatest talker in the history of the business is behind the mic once again.
You're talking to the Rolex-wearing, diamond ring-wearing, kiss-stealing, wheel-and-dealing, limousine-like, jet-flying son of a gun.
This is Woo Nation with Ric Flair.
I'm the man.
Hi, this is Ric Flair, 16 times your world champion, hosting my show, Woo Nation, along with my good friend and co-host, Conrad Thompson, and our guest today, Conrad, the legendary Bret Hart. Bret, how are you?
I'm good.
Thank you so much. The best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. And that's the last thing I said to you as I saw you in San Jose, and I exited the room, and you had a line a mile long, longer than mine this time, which really pissed me off.
Well, it was San Jose. The whole experience was a good experience. Yeah, I had a lot of fun there.
It was great. Saw you and your lovely wife. I met your son, who I still can't believe, 6'4", 240, and he's not in the business. Good for him.
Yeah.
Good for him. Jeez.
I shake my head, too.
No, but I'm saying it's this business right now. My daughter is up to her eyes in it, as you know, right? But I mean, it's difficult out there right now. It's not like the kids are having a lot of fun like you and I had when we started. So,
but yeah, anyway, it's a whole different thing now.
Oh, totally different. Jeez. So, well, anyway, my fondest stories about Bret when he was young is his dad, Stu Hart, had a legendary promotion in the Calgary, Canada.
And, Stampede, right?
The Calgary Stampede, right. Well, that was the theme of one of their shows. Was the name of the promotion the Calgary Stampede?
Yeah, it's called Stampede Wrestling.
Stampede Wrestling, okay. And so the legendary, as I broke into business with Vern Gagne, everybody talked about probably the two, you know, most famous people training people to get into business were Stu Hart, Stu with his dungeon,
right?
You know, which Bret probably hates the memories of, and Vern with his barn out in Minnesota, and very comparable weather, 30 below zero. So when I first won the NWA title, I went into Reno, and I met Stu for the first time. And Bret, you were there with your brothers, right?
Well, first time I met you was in Las Vegas.
Oh, okay. At the NWA convention,
just before,
right?
Before the big war. Yeah, the NWA one. I know Vern came through town.
Yes, exactly.
I remember all the NWA guys running around saying that Vern Gagne was in the lobby or something like that.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was. I know what he was there for. He slapped Bill Watts.
Wow.
Did you ever hear that story?
No.
Yeah, Bill Watts was trying to steal the Oklahoma territory from Leroy McGurk and Vern. Vern took it as stealing. Vern flew out to Vegas and he smacked Bill Watts.
Wow.
But that was Vern. I mean, Vern was like very much like your dad. He wasn't shy, right?
Yeah, he was very, very direct kind of guy.
Yeah. So, anyway, I can't do with the voice, but he goes, Bret's dad, it's funny over the years, people like Shawn Michaels and that, they probably didn't know him nearly as well as I did. But he goes, so you're Ric Flair, eh? I hear you're a pretty fair hand. Are you? How do you answer that question? I hope so. How'd that sound, Bret? Was I close?
That sounds very close and sounds like one of those kind of questions that my dad would ask.
Oh, yeah.
You have a hard time answering.
I hear you're a pretty fair hand. Are you? Oh, I hope so. I'm the world champion. I don't know what that means in Calgary, but down here. So anyway, but his dad commanded like the kind of respect that... he was the Vince McMahon, Vern Gagne... Fritz Von Erich, I mean, that kind of respect. I mean, he was that highly thought of and in the NWA. And not to take anything out of context, but one of the angles that I hated the most in your career, Brett, was the one you shot with Jerry Lawler when he was messing around with your mom and dad. That got heat with me, and I'm one of the boys. Do you remember that?
I can remember Olin actually coming to me and saying that he thought that that Lawler was going a little too strong.
Oh, man, I'm watching that. I was getting pissed off, and it wasn't even my mom and dad. Because you were at that's when they were doing Raw at the old the little building downtown.
Manhattan Center.
Yes, sir. So,
but you know, the thing about that was, you know, when I remember coming home to actually talk to my mom and dad and see if it did kind of rile them up, and they loved it. They were laughing their heads off and watching it back on the replay later that day on TV. And my mom was just loved it. I think just the whole humor of it. I think she got a kick out of all the stuff Lawler said about my dad. You know, he put his false teeth in backwards and all that. All those jokes that Lawler had. He was pretty funny, and I think somehow my mom got the humor. I remember looking at Olin and going, we don't need to say anything to Jerry about this. Like, probably we were going to tell him to tone it down, but you know, once we got home and saw how much they liked it, we never had a problem with it.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because as you get older, and trust me, I know that feeling. We'll do just about anything to be part of the show. Especially me. They can beat me up, throw me around, roll me in a ball. I don't care. Just give me some time on Raw. So I can sit next to Brett and sign autographs next weekend. Oh, man. Well, Conrad's got a whole pile of stuff for you. And you've met Conrad twice with me at the last two WrestleManias. He's a huge fan. And he probably knows more about the business than Meltzer.
That's a pretty bold statement. That's a big pair of shoes to fill.
I do want to ask, though, Brett, back when you were first starting with Stampede, how hard was it to be the promoter's son? I mean, that had to be just a totally different dynamic from, you know, being in the locker room with the boys and the eyes of the fans, you know, just being who your dad was. How difficult was that for you?
Well, you know, I think... I think it could have been difficult for me, but I think right from the time that I got in working for my dad, I think I was sort of sorely needed as one of his better workers, even when I first started. And I think I always thought the way the wrestlers treated me, they always had a lot of respect for my work rate and my sort of whole approach to the business. Back in those days, if I was driving the van or if I was picking up the money for the towns or whatever it was, I know that all the wrestlers thought I was pretty reliable and pretty, always reasonable and never asked anyone to do anything I wouldn't do myself kind of thing. And, I kind of had a nice respect going into the business and, I refereed for a little while and I think I started to learn the business, but I always felt that it was kind of a mixed bag of nuts, the whole thing of being a promoter's kid. Some ways it had lots of benefits, and you were treated a little better, that you were at least connected or you were important. So, any promoter's kid usually got treated with respect. But on the other hand, you also had to earn it. And, a lot of promoter's kids did earn it. I always heard Greg Gagne was a hard worker and a decent worker and stuff like that. And I know there's certain promoters' kids were decent workers, and then there was other promoters' kids that kind of dropped the ball and kind of made all promoters' kids look bad. And I don't need to say who they were, but there was just different promoters that you had respect for, and ones that, as far as the kids went, you didn't.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you today, Brett, was regarding the match that was finally released just a couple years ago on DVD between yourself and Tiger Mask. It seemed like that one was one that longtime fans had wanted to see forever and ever, and finally the WWE put it out there. And I guess this is a question for you too, Rick. How difficult was it calling a match with a language barrier where you speak English, he speaks Japanese, and somehow you guys are supposed to put on a hell of a match? How difficult was that, and what were your philosophies in pulling that off?
Well, for me, most of the Japanese guys I ever worked with, they're almost taught in Japan all the English names for everything. So, they can't speak English, but they can call a match. Like, they know what a drop kick is, and they know all the words for all the moves. So, the language barrier wasn't such a problem. Most of the time when if there was a screw up or a mistake, you certainly couldn't communicate very well because they didn't speak any English other than wrestling moves.
Yeah, I'd agree. You know, they just were tough kids. I mean, I'm sure Brett will agree with you. They, we train hard here. We did. I mean, Brett and I, you know, started at a time when it was tough to get in this business, and we started for promotions that were hard on you. And I heard Stu stretched everybody, as did Vern and Billy Robinson and the guys that I broke in with. But those Japanese kids are tougher than hell. I mean, they were back then, right, Brett? And
they were always super, super fit.
Yeah, super, super
and well-schooled in wrestling. Like, they all knew how to shoot a double-leg takedown and basic wrestling. They were all pretty skilled.
Yeah, and they're not afraid of anything. So, and they know the way to get over is to beat and recognize or to have a good match or whatever the word would be with a recognized American star. So I like going to Japan, but I didn't like working with some of the guys. I mean, I couldn't do anything with Jumbo Tsuruta. And Tenryu was great. I loved him, and I loved Choshu and some of those guys. But and of course, I love wrestling with Muda and Fujinami, who I inducted this year. But some of the guys, man, I couldn't handle. And they didn't think I was tough enough, so they didn't care. But that's why they sent Harley over a couple of times as my bodyguard to make sure they didn't swap the title.
Well, speaking of swapping titles, Brett, you won your first world title from our host, of course, Ric Flair, and it was actually taped for a Coliseum home video release filmed in October of 92. When did you guys know about this, and kind of when was the plan, and how did you guys find out?
Well, for me, it was all it was all one day. I didn't find anything out until the morning of the show earlier that day. I got told to fly to Saskatoon to meet Vince McMahon at, I think it was 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I had changed my airplane ticket flying from England, which was a big no-no or something at the time. So I thought I was going to get trouble. I thought I was in trouble. Chief Jay, who told me the night before that they had changed my flight, and I was on the first flight in the morning to Saskatoon, and Vince wanted to see me straight at the building straight away, and first thing in the morning. I had no idea. I really should have known or could have known, but I'd even heard something a few weeks before about they were looking to put the belt on somebody, and I never thought about it that morning. I remember kind of flying there kind of scared that I was going to get fined or something like that. It was quite strange to actually sit outside. I sat at the end of a long hallway, and when I got there, they said, Vince is in there with Rick. And so I went and sat. There was only one chair, and I remember it was way, way far at the other end of the hall. And I sat down and waited for Rick to come out. And Rick came out, shook Vince's hand, and they had a good sort of goodbye or whatever. And he walked down the hall, but he went the other way. And so I never did see Rick. He went up the other way out. And then Vince looked down the hall and called me down. And like I said, I thought, and the way Vince told me was, he sort of made out like, you know, how long I've been there and how many belts have they put on me already, and they had done everything they could do with me. And then he just was just about to, my mind to tell me that it was time to let me go. I remember actually sitting there thinking that Vince was going to fire me that day for some reason, and that my dad was supposed to be flying in to be in my corner that night. And I remember going, I don't know how I'm going to explain to him that there's no, you know, I was kind of just concerned about the whole thing. And then Vince, I remember just looked at me and said, so we're going to put the big belt on you tonight. And I never said a word to him. And I remember he looked at me and said, you should at least smile or clap or something. Or I've never seen anyone with no expression. And I remember I said, I'm just not sure whether I even believe it yet, you know, because like, they'd said some of the things to me over the years that never, ever happened, you know. It was like, I still think if they'd said to me, you know, if they'd announced to the dressing room in June that they were going to put the belt on me and at the same time, they would have changed their mind by the time they got to that day, if they'd had more time to think about it. But it was so quick and so sudden, you know. I always you know, remember it being my favorite day in the business.
Would you call that your favorite day in the business?
Yeah, I think that was the biggest stun, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I didn't believe it till it happened.
Yeah. Well, for me,
I actually had the belt in my hand and was the champion. It was like I couldn't believe it was going to happen. Was happening. It was all too surreal for me.
Yeah. Well, what happened? Brett knows this now. Is I was wrestling the Ultimate Warrior on Friday night, and Charles Barkley had come to see me in Phoenix. And the Warrior suplexed me and dropped me on my head, and I had that inner ear problem. And I already was told that they were going to make Brett the champion, but it was like at a different time.
Right.
But I had that inner ear problem, and I couldn't work the next day. And then they called me and said, you're going to drop it to Brett on Monday night. And I said, well, I can hardly stand up. Because I could take a bump, but I couldn't get up fast.
I see.
Because my equilibrium, in other words, if I went down flat, when I got up for about 8, maybe 10 seconds, I was dizzy, right? So, as a matter of fact, I thought it was something wrong with me, like I was gonna, like I had some kind of a neurological problem, but it was an inner ear problem. So, I got there, and I'd already heard that I was going to drop it to Brett, but I wish it had been for me. I told Brett this 10 times. I wish it had been when I could work better, because I just couldn't get up. He could give me his moves, but I couldn't get up and feed fast enough.
Sure.
Whatever the occasion called for. But anyway, when it got better, as a result of me not, it did get better. The day I was supposed to get my Lloyd's of London money, Brett, you don't know this. After 3 months, the day I was supposed to get my Lloyd's of London money, I woke up and it was fixed. I went over and hit my head against the wall 3 times and said, what in the hell? I'm flying to Minneapolis to get the money to go, you know, the 500 grand or whatever it is, 750, right? And everybody else gotten all this money over, you know, half the guys faked the injuries, right? And I'm going to get my money, and I woke up, I hit my head against the wall 3 times. I was in Louisville, Kentucky. I said, I can't believe this. I'm fine. I called my dad. I said, Dad, I'm going to say I'm so dizzy. He said, no, you're not. It's karma. I said, yeah, I'm still right. I am. I'm dizzy. I want that damn money. I was paying $35,000 a year premium for that stuff, you know. So that's my memory of it. But I remember, I thought we had some really good matches afterwards, but the night I gave it to him, it was no.
So you were disappointed in the match that night, though.
Oh, I couldn't pull off my end. You know, Brett was probably so excited he didn't notice it, but I couldn't pull off my end, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I couldn't do my upside down. I thought we had a lot of fun afterwards, but I certainly could have given you a better match that night. But, you know, it didn't matter. You know, at some point in your life, if you're having fun with the guy you're working with, you'd rather do that than anything. I mean, and finally, I mean, this guy, you know, Brett, technician, in great shape, cares about the business. I mean, you know, it was fun for me, so I have fond memories of it, and I certainly don't regret the night, that's for sure.
I always had especially fond memories of just prior to winning the belt. We had such good matches in Germany. I remember we stole a show every night in Germany, left them just going crazy. When we were walking out back to the dressing room, the place was just going crazy.
I remember
all those days. Every show I ever worked in Germany was sold out, but those ones just before I won the title were really special nights.
That was you and me, right?
Yeah, everywhere. I think every other night I worked with Papa Shango.
Yeah.
But I had really good matches with, like, two different kind of style matches. And really, the fans would go to all different shows.
Yeah.
It worked out really well for me. I had really good matches with you, and I just remember you always got me over really strong, and you always walking back to the dressing room with the belt, kind of just barely, like, you survived a really tough match. And I just remember the German fans just clapping and cheering, like, they got the great world, and it was a great feeling just before
a woman. Well, you know, I don't think I've told 10 people this or anything. Conrad knows this, but we're at SummerSlam in London, and I just knew Brett a little bit. You know, we always got along great, but I didn't know him that well, right?
Right.
And I'm there managing Henning, I think, something to do with Randy Savage, and he wrestles Davey Boy, right? And I'd never seen this, which I put it into my routine right away with guys I could trust, but Brett being one of them. Brett gives Davey Boy this superplex off the top rope.
Right.
So I go back to the hotel and I knock on Bret Hart's door. I said, if I'd known you could work like that, you son of a bitch, I'd be kissing your ass a long time ago. I didn't know you could work like that. Because I always saw you in tag matches. Do you remember that?
I don't know if you remember who was with you. Macho Man was with you.
No, Macho. Macho Man. I mean, I go, that son of a bitch can really work. Holy shit. I mean, you and Davey Boy, and not just because it was London. I don't give a shit if someone's going to say it was Davey Boy's home country. That match, nothing followed it the rest of the night.
It was the main event.
Yeah,
that was the last
match. I thought the Warrior and Savage was the main event.
That was actually earlier.
I was going to say, the Warrior and Savage didn't die. Whatever, we were.
Couldn't hold
thank God we were around before that. Jesus Christ, but that was unbelievable.
I remember a couple times. I was in Baltimore the day after when we got back because we had TVs or something like that. But I remember you and Macho Man watched it on closed circuit in the hotel room.
Yeah.
And you came and found me at my room. Shook my hand, both of you, and said that was the greatest match you ever watched. And you both just wanted to come shake my hand for putting on such a good match.
Yeah, no, it was unreal. I guess it was. I was trying to think. We were having a pretty good party at the Holiday Inn after SummerSlam, so I probably was thought you had to get a draw from Arnie to get out of the place. As Brett can vouch for, I didn't miss anything in the nightlife over there. Can you imagine taking the crew to London for 7 days now for a show?
Yeah.
We lost Mike Hagstrand on that tour, and what was the other kid's name from Minneapolis? John Nord. John and Mike Ekstrand just departed the company voluntarily. Didn't come home.
They quit completely and just stayed there for about 3 months.
I know. The Road Warriors were no more. I saw Joe, and I tell Joe that's one of the greatest stories. I said, where's Mike? And he just got in a motorcycle and kept riding. what are you going to say about that? I mean... Oh God! I left there. My credit card has bounced a lot of times over the years, but not as high as it bounced in the lobby that Holiday Inn when I was leaving. I called Arnold Skoll and I said, "Arnie, I need a draw, man, now, major." And could I have 500 more to get home on? Who's got a $3,000 bar tab in 1991?
Ric Flair.
Yeah, I know.
That's it.
I'm done.
We're talking with Brett the Hitman Hart here on Woo Nation right here at play.it. And I want to talk to you guys about WrestleMania 8 from Indianapolis. At the time, Blood was banned in the WWF, and two guys bled that night, and it was Bret Hart and Ric Flair. But I think only one of you got in trouble. What was the story there, Brett, as you remember it?
He wrestled Roddy Piper there.
That's right.
All I can say about that, I think, is that it was just a matter of placement on the card, probably. You know, I don't think anyone talked about it. I think it was something we kept pretty close vest about it in our match, and I think that Randy and Rick did the same. It was just we were out there first. That's all it really is to that.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I didn't get in trouble, but he just pulled me into the side and... Because Macho, you know, said, you get some juice from me. I said, yeah. I mean, what the hell, you know? It's Randy Savage. I don't care.
Right.
And nobody said don't, so it isn't like, but I didn't ask. And I'm walking down the hall, you know, thinking I had a pretty good match with Randy. And, you know, as you know, Brett, at that time, the tension with Randy and Liz was at all-time high. That was one of the hardest weeks I've ever been through. Because I had to go to Tampa and practice, and I'm not used to doing that, and practice all week long. And, you know, Randy had to have it written down and scripted, you know, which is okay. But he and Liz were barely talking at that. As a matter of fact, that's the last time they performed together. And so I thought we had a pretty good match. It was far from great, but it was a pretty good match. And I'm walking down the hall, and Vince Patterson came and got me and said, Vince, I want to talk to you. And I thought he was going to say, good job, man. You know, sorry for all the tension. He looked at me and said... Every time you get this close to greatness, you do something to screw it up. And I said, look, what did I tell you? I said, who told you to cut yourself? And I said, I don't know. I just did it on my own. He said, well, that's what I'm talking about. You don't do that without letting me know. Not thank you, nothing.
Wow.
See you. See you when I see you, Rick. TV tomorrow. Don't be late. That was it.
That was kind of the. Well, I kind of knew that was what it was. So, you know, I did my best anyway to make it look like an accident. And for the most part, I think they believed me. And I think even they watched it back. They weren't sure whether it happened or not, or what happened.
Yeah,
I don't know. My memory of it was that maybe it was just bullshit at the time. Was that Rick and Randy got fined for it, and me and Roddy never said a word to us about it.
No, I didn't get fined. I just he knows how to get to me by saying something that hurts my feelings. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the fine would be nothing to me, but he could. Vince has got a way of, you know, because he's such a, and as you know, Brett, he anything that Vince McMahon asks you to do, pretty much he'll do himself. And he lives by that, and he, to me, he's always been very fair, but he wants the heads up, you know, and I can remember, he's not shy about telling him, and you know, I came out of the ring one night, and he goes, 80s heels don't draw anymore. What are you doing? You know, this is like, this is in 2003, talking about me being an 80s heel. I don't know. What do you mean? What's changed in time here? So, you know, you got to be a good guy and a bad guy. But he'll just go off on me for one, you know. And another time he said, where'd you learn that slam off the top rope? And I said, from Harley Race. He said, just get out of my office now. Brett calls it the Beal off the top rope. Brett says, why do you take a Beal all the time? I said, I don't take a Beal. He said, yeah, you do off the top rope. Well, I called it a slam. Brett called it a Beal. I didn't know what he was talking about. Oh, man, we've had so much fun.
We've got the greatest in here right now. We've got Brett the Hitman Hart on the line with us here on Woo Nation at play.it. And I guess we should just go ahead and address the elephant in the room. In years past, Brett, you've been critical of some of Rick's matches, and I realize everybody's getting along these days, so I don't really want to stir it up, so to speak. But how do you think you guys' philosophies differ towards wrestling, or what makes a good match, and how did you guys just see things differently through the years?
And you can say what you can say whatever you want to say while still be text buddies.
Is a little bit taken out of context, I think, a little bit. What I would say is that we just have sort of just overlapping eras. You know, his era and my era just are very close. I mean, I was a guy that, like he said, when he was talking about Randy, you know, I could always go in the ring and call a match out there. I didn't need to even plan anything. Like zero, I'd go out and do an hour match with Rick. I don't think without ever talking to him before we went out. And I could do that with Rick at any given time. At the same time, I was also part of the Dynamite Kid and a different generation that was going a lot faster and doing a lot more sort of intricate new high spots that weren't sort of the same ones. Because there was a period of time, you know, through the Dory Funk era and even the Harley era, a lot of guys just worked like them. A lot of them, people just took the same bumps, the same style, that basically had the same match Harley had before he went out. And that was just the style that everyone picked up. It was a good, safe style, but it was, I thought the 80s, early 80s, that in Calgary, that we started being a little more creative with actual working, where it was a little stiffer, a little more believable. Dynamite was an incredible wrestler that had, long before he ever got to WWE, the stuff he was doing here in Calgary was ahead of its time. And so I learned from some good guys a little more of a different style, which I think, you know, I didn't have the pleasure of working with just American wrestlers. Like, say, Rick worked with a lot of American guys, you know, the best workers in the States, where I, you know, worked with guys in England and worked with Japanese guys and Puerto Ricans and a lot of different styles and stuff like that. And I just think that when my time came, after Rick's time was sort of still wrestling, the way they call it in there. They figure it out on the fly, and that's what makes the genius of those days. And I knew that from, you know, Harley, and I worked just... I actually started as that era was changing a little bit. And I think, I don't know, maybe I was a pioneer or something with Dynamite and some of these guys that started taking wrestling in a little bit of a different direction and picking up the speed. And, I always say that when the Bulldogs came to the WWE, for example, in 84, I think it was 85, you know, everybody started working harder, and that's just the way the style changed. And I think the business got better after that. I think it just was the natural, you know, path that the wrestling was going to take, and wrestling kind of upped a little bit after in the 80s. And I'm sure Rick's got his own thoughts on it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm the first to admit, when you wrestle an hour every night, which I did for 10 right. years, you know, you get into a routine, you know, and you hope that the guy you're working with is just a little bit over. Because sometimes if he's not, it could be a long hour.
Well, in fairness, too, a lot of that, when you were doing those hour matches, weren't on cable every week. So it's not like the same people are seeing the same match every week.
No, but
you do it in Greensboro.
The boys are seeing it.
Right,
and I think that I'm the first to admit. But you know, I didn't have the blessing of a Ricky Steamboat or a Barry Windham every night. You know what I mean? And Harley would let me lead the match, but I wrestled Harley's match. Dory would let me lead the match, you know, after a while, but I wrestled Dory's match. Terry Funk, he'd let me lead after a while when he was comfortable, but I wrestled Terry's match. Terry, of course, became so innovative in his own style. I mean, you know, I bet you feel the same way, Brett. Terry Funk and Dick Murdoch were way ahead of their time, man, where they could be such serious technical guys. But Murdoch could make people laugh, too, way before anybody else could. I mean, he'd take a bump over the top rope in St. Louis when nobody was doing anything and walk into the turnbuckle and knock himself out. I mean, nobody did that. And Murdoch, at the same time, Murdoch could get in the ring, and technically there weren't too many guys as good as Dick Murdoch. Would you agree, Brett?
Oh, he was a real pro.
Jesus.
He was one of those kind of guys that you'd love – you loved him in the ring, and you loved him out of the ring. He was a hilarious character outside the ring.
Oh, it's tremendous
very,
to
very
be with.
Very funny. Had a dry sense of humor. Sarcastic. He was a very funny. You could have followed him around all day and always had a laugh with him.
Yeah, I did for 3 years. Then I got rid of him when he came to the Carolinas, the redneck. But he was God. I tell you. Murdoch, he had his style too, but everything he did from the stomp, you know, turning your face sideways and stomping you in the head to his punches, everything he did looked phenomenal. I mean, you can't pick apart any of his stuff. But at the same time,
he could do a knee drop off the top rope that looked unbelievable.
Exactly. And he's one of the few guys. He's one of the few guys you'd take it from too, him and Ray.
Yeah, you don't even have to move. You know, no. You just know that he was always a safe. Safety was always mm-hmm. Dick Murdoch's priority. I don't remember him ever being even stiff, but just a super player to work with every night.
Yeah, no, and the thing, too, is that if you think about it, this is a guy that he was like Ray Stevens. He never went to the gym, never right. worked out. I mean, Harley never went to the gym, never worked out. I mean, these guys, you know, where Brett and I are in this era where cosmetics are everything. I mean, you know, we're I'm wrestling Kerry Von Erich one night, Steamboat the next. I mean, help me out, right?
Right.
Then along comes Luger, right? And all the Von Erich boys, you know, with the exception of David, were built, you know, like crazy. And then got Luger, and then here comes the Road Warriors. I mean, the cosmetic thing kind of turned it around for all of us, you know. I mean, you have to admit, Brett, I mean, you and I, you more so than me, but, you know, we were not exactly the cosmetic poster boys that some of these guys were. That Kerry Von Erich just, you know, he was, you know, the most phenomenally genetically gifted guy I think I've ever seen. His genetics were phenomenal. I'm sure he had some help along the way, but it didn't matter. He looked like $1 million. And then Luger and then Steamboat. And, I mean, a lot of the guys just had great physiques. You know, so if you could work, you know, we try to, I think Brett, I'm speaking for Brett and I, we counted on our work and our entertainment, I mean, on our work rate, probably more than our look to be successful in the business.
Well, my strongest suit was always my work rate, you know, mm-hmm. how good I worked. But, you know, and when I first started, I was, you know, I always had a lot of trouble doing promos and trying to be a baby face or find my way as a baby face. And, you know, cause I always, people will, you know, talk about my capabilities as a promo guy, but it was always hard to do promos and not have any confidence. Like when you sort of knew you were just going to go out and do a job for somebody, especially, you know, when I first got to WWE, it was kind of, I was just a stepping stone from being like a regular jobber that, you know, just started doing jobs for everybody. And it was like I was fighting my hardest not to get into that category. And then, you know, it was like, here, do promos. When I got turned babyface, I was under the impression they were going to give me this big push. And so I was sort of semi-cautious with my promos in the beginning. And then right away I found out I was like basically doing jobs for Bad News and getting him ready for Hogan. And
Doing jobs for who, Brett?
As a babyface, and Bad News Brown or Bad News Allen, remember him?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. I never met him, but I know, yeah. I know the name.
They turned me babyface in the story, in an angle with him at the WrestleMania or whatever. But anyway, they just, you know, when they, in order to have good promos, you gotta feel some kind of confidence or sort of faith that they're going to give you a little push. And I found that every time I got into that sort of situation where I could start speaking with a little more confidence in my promos, they automatically started beating me, and I kind of lost all that confidence and realized that I was just a stepping stone for somebody else to make money. And, you know, so you kind of went through that phase all the time until suddenly one day, you know, they sort of give you the real push, which probably was the Intercontinental belt, and you start getting a real push. And then you start going out there with confidence and talking for your promos, and they start going, oh, he's finally starting to learn how to do promos. I think it's a little bit, you know, you do the best you can with what you got.
Well, and then you get a chance to help others, you know, come up to that next level. And you certainly did that after a break in 96 when you came back and you asked to work with Steve Austin, and that really helped him move up a level. What did you see in him to make you want to work with him on your comeback?
You know, when I first saw Steve, he was in WCW, and I liked his work. I liked his look, and I thought, this is the kind of guy that I could, if I worked with him, I could make him look good. Like, I'd give him a really good match. I could just see it the way he worked, that I would mix well with him, our styles. And I remember trying to talk Vince into bringing him in, and especially after I heard somewhere that he was in ECW, and I remember telling Vince that they should try to get him in if he's that available. And next thing you know, he was in the dressing room walking around, and it was like somebody had called him, and, you know, like that, he was in WWE. And I was on with Steve. I worked with him in the beginning when he first got there, and I think, you know, I guess at that time I'd already... They worked with Rick, and I started to have a lot of really good matches under my belt, where I was pretty good out there with my psychology and stuff. And I found that when I worked with Steve, in the beginning anyway, he was a little bit erratic and a little bit, sometimes he just kind of lose control out there, you know, where he just started going so fast, kind of like a windmill, where he didn't know what to do next. And he'd forget everything you planned out or talked about, and just kind of just make a left turn and get lost, kind of thing. And you'd have to kind of swing around, get him back on track, and get him right back into it. And I found that he started to trust me over time to kind of, you know, teach him how to not to panic in the match. Because sometimes he'd just kind of panic and just start going crazy, you know. And I think that helped kind of calm Steve down and make him sort of just relax and play his character and focus on the match. And just, it was like, so a lot of times with Steve, it was just great acting.
Yeah.
You know, well, he said the stuff.
Brett.
Looked really.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you think it might have been the 5 Rip Fuels he drinks a day? Jesus.
Maybe.
I own 10 Gold Gyms, and I couldn't have kept Steve in Rip Fuel. Like, you know, I'm drinking the coffee like crazy. I didn't know Rip Fuel. I used to, when my son Reed was amateur wrestling, right? And I saw these kids in Oklahoma be running around the mat. I mean, like they were, you know, on an Adderall or something, right? And so I figured out that I started getting his amino drink, right, and putting Rip Fuel in it to compete with the 12-year-olds. But I drink a Rip Fuel, man, and I'm walking around until, you know, 3 a.m. the next afternoon. And Steve, man, Steve can drink that Rip Fuel. Nobody can stand in the corner and kick somebody 100 times in the stomach and not be out of breath, except for Steve Austin. Jesus, I love it. But I can see where I loved working with Steve, too. But, man, he doesn't get tired. And he trains very hard.
Sure.
But, that Rip Fuel man. Jesus.
I always loved the matches I had with Steve. I always thought he was a talented worker, and especially as he became, you know, got away from the stunning, you know, Steve Austin thing and becoming more Stone Cold.
Yeah.
Even in that transition, he was still a lot of fun to work with, and you know, I actually really enjoyed working with Steve right from the start, and I think the match we had at WrestleMania 13 was
amazing.
Still one of my favorite matches ever to watch sit back and watch a match back. I'd love to watch it with Steve. We have a lot of memories from that match. There's a lot of little funny little, not even funny, but just really intricate little moments of that match. It was a brilliant match, I think.
It was in March of 97 in Chicago. Uh-huh. It was an I Quit. Ken Shamrock was the referee.
Oh, okay.
Austin bled out. Probably the best WrestleMania match at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it was the best WrestleMania match.
1986?
1997.
97, I was going to say. 86. Yes, geez, Brett was 14 years old.
Brett, earlier this year, Bischoff did an interview where he said that you offered to bring the WWF belt to Nitro with you, but all we've ever heard from you is that you would drop the belt, you know, on Raw the night after Survivor Series. Is Bischoff lying, or did you offer to bring the belt?
No, that's not true. I mean, to be really honest, it just doesn't really make any sense. I lost the belt to Sean. I didn't have a belt.
I think he's saying in the negotiations when you were first, you know, making contact with him about coming back.
No, I don't. If it was brought up, it wasn't brought up by me.
Right.
You know, it was not anything I would have done ever. It was not something that I would have ever. Like, I was hoping to leave the company on good terms and maybe even come back when I was done with WCW. I didn't even want to leave. If anything, I was thinking more than I would end up staying there, to be honest. I only made the decision to go with Bischoff and those guys at the very end, at the last minute, when I had nowhere else to kind of turn. When Vince kind of basically, you know, gave me no option but to sign off. I think he was trying to get me out by then. And so there's no, I didn't have a belt to do it with, and it's just not something that I would have volunteered, because it's not something I would have done. But, you know, Eric seems to have a pretty fuzzy memory with all that stuff anyway.
Yeah, well, don't we all? You know, I tell the story.
Well, I got a vivid memory of the WCW guys. They were so fucked up.
Oh, Brett. Hey, now here's the rib on me, right? So I know Brett's coming down, right? And I don't have a position, but I know Brett's coming. I'll tell you what, I was in Buffalo, New York with Bischoff, and I said, let me work with Bret Hart. He goes, well, what do you think? I said, I promise you, me and Bret Hart, you know.
Right.
He said, you got a problem, beat you? I said, Eric, you're having, what's the guy? What was the Mexican guy? Conan beat me last week, okay? Yeah, Bret Hart can beat me, no problem. So we go to Dayton, Ohio, and it's me and Bret, right, in pay-per-view. The main event is Savage and Nash. And Bret and I went in that ring in Dayton, Ohio, man, and they're still standing there, man. And they kept saying go home, and they you know, when Brett put the sharpshooter on me, I had to figure four. He superplexed me off the top rope. I mean, there was nothing left. There was nothing left for them, right? And
right.
Brett and I go walking through the curtains, and Randy Savage, God rest his soul, he was screaming at me, and he wouldn't say shit to Brett. God damn it, you went too long. What are you talking about? You left me in Nash. Right. I started laughing to myself. I went back to the Marriott and had another drink. Jesus. You remember that, Brett? He was out of his mind.
Yeah, I do. I do remember having a really good match for the end.
Oh, God. It was like, and we just did a little deal. I walked out. We were in St. Louis, of all places. And Brett's out there, and I walk up to him. You know, I can always make Brett laugh in the ring, and I go, so listen, kid, while you were in Calgary training, I said I was in, in Singapore wrestling Brody, and the natives were restless, and Brett started laughing. I played back some of our YouTube stuff, man. It was worth that. We had to get paid for this stuff, Brett. I should look at him and say, well, you were in the Calgary training in the dungeon. I was in Singapore wrestling Brody, and the natives were restless, and Brett started laughing. Not too much heat going on there, but we had just had
there's
fun.
One interview where we did, I don't know, I got a brown T-shirt on it, and then I remember you end up popping a bunch of elbows on your jacket and all that. I remember just, It was a classic. I saw it on YouTube. My wife played it for me a few months ago. Made me laugh. Made me burst out laughing at how.
I know.
It was a hilarious of both of us in our prime, sort of.
Yeah. Well, God.
Playing along with our characters and stuff and having a lot of fun.
Yeah. I go to them and say that little thing they say, you know, like.
Yeah.
That's the one.
That's how it started. He goes, you know, the little rhyme you have, I mean, you know, something. We just had great chemistry. We didn't rehearse shit. You know, I said, Brett, let's go out there and have fun. And it was St. Louis, it was sold out. Remember, it was the TWA Dome. Another town that the WCW had a good house in before they killed. God, there are 20,000 people, me and Brett, right? How hard was that in St. Louis? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Two names synonymous with wrestling in a wrestling town.
There was so much potential in those days. And, you know, even like you're talking about that promo, I remember when that place was buzzing and just totally lit up.
You and I could have worked for a year.
Come back to the dressing room and they don't do anything with you, you know. They just pass on you again the next week and...
No, but I mean, you and I could have had a year-long program. God forbid that Flair get a program with Bret Hart for a year. We could have wrestled for a year. I mean,
we could have wrestled the whole time I was there.
And yeah.
Better than what they did.
No, God forbid you get next to me in WCW, you're done. That was the way of the place.
As a fan, I was glad that they booked you guys together because when Brett was first brought in, it was he was there at the end of the Starrcade 97 main event. They tried to do a little takeoff of the Montreal incident, and Nick Patrick was supposed to do a fast count, or at least that was the plan, and then, you know, that didn't really go down exactly as they'd hoped. And Bischoff recently said he believes that Hogan put Nick Patrick up to do an irregular count. Brett, you were there ringside. What were you thinking when all this happened? And is that when you realized this is not going to be as fun as maybe you originally thought?
Well, you know what? I'll be honest. I thought it was a pretty lousy finish in the first place. The whole thing was stupid and made little sense. Who was it? Seemed like a really
Hogan and Sting.
Dumb idea.
Hogan and Sting.
To bring me in as a referee out of nowhere. The whole thing was nonsensical. It didn't make any sense. But it was like, okay, well, Bischoff's supposed to be the genius, and they're doing so great. You know, I gotta just sort of listen to what they're telling me to do and do it the best I can. And it was a lousy idea, and you can blame the referee all you want, but it was a lousy idea, and the finish didn't work because he counted way too fast because he forgot that he had to count slow, and, you know, it just sort of went downhill from there, where it was like, that was probably the highlight of my career there. So, you know, you know, it really didn't. I never thought, and I think Rick will tell you the same thing, is at least when you went to WWF, you knew what you were doing. You know, you really got a clear picture of what you were doing for the next while, and you know how to put your input in and how to make things better. They give you enough of an idea what you're doing the next couple of weeks to sort of, and who you were working with and what you needed to try to do as far as your storyline went. You know, with WCW. I don't think they knew shit. They never knew zero. And they couldn't lace Vince McMahon's shoes up. They were so bad, they didn't know anything about anything. There was a bunch of little morons telling people what to do. Guys like Kevin Sullivan were giving finishes to guys like me, and I just scratched my head and go, what am I taking orders from Kevin Sullivan for? Like, who the hell is Kevin Sullivan to be giving? You know, I think there's a big difference between Vince McMahon and, you know, Vince, at least when he hired guys to be agents and guys that would tell you what to do, they were all top pros that had, you know, years and years of experience. And they were all good, like from Lanza to Chief J to, you know, Rene Goulet and even Tony Garea and those guys. They at least knew what a good match was. And they knew, you know, who had good heat. They knew how... the sound of the crowd and what the, you know, they can just tell you stuff that, you know, guys in WCW, I thought were really inferior, you know, and the whole experience there, I think is they're on the verge of unbelievable greatness. And I can only imagine if they'd had some kind of, you know, leadership there, you know, someone that really did know what they were doing, that company would be every bit as big as WWE is today.
Yeah, direction.
You know, and that would be so much better for the wrestlers in the business, because then there would be some kind of leverage where you could go from one company to the other, or you could always be a threat to, you know, just like in Japan, with All Japan and New Japan. But all that benefits the wrestlers, and, you know, Eric Bischoff and all those morons underneath him, they dropped the ball and killed something that was going to be great for everybody. It should have been great for everybody. And it's too bad because there's guys in the industry like Rick and myself that and a lot of guys we've talked about in the last last little while that made this business mean something back then and made people start getting interested in it and start to follow. And it wasn't about the bodies. It was about the work in the ring and the matches themselves. And if you look at, from the time that me and Rick were, I would say, in our prime in the 90s, they were going away from the bodies and the build, the Hogans and the Billy Graham superstars. It was about the work rate and the workers of the business. And that's why they remember me and Rick today better than they remember, I think, the bodybuilders from that era.
Yeah, I mean, I without slapping each other on the back, if you could work, it's like, there's never going to be another Ricky Steamboat. I mean, it's just the way there is, And I don't know, you never met Wahoo, but I mean, there's some guys that stand out in my mind, and guys that I got to work with, And Brett, you're one of them too. I mean, and Sean, I mean, Triple H. I don't know. Did you ever get to wrestle Angle?
No, I never got to work with Kurt.
God, Kurt
but
Angle.
I did get to know Wahoo in Japan.
Yeah, you had to know Wahoo, right?
Well. He was. I never worked with Wahoo.
You never worked with him?
I only worked with him as a partner.
Yeah,
we tagged up over there.
Yeah,
but he was a tough guy and a great character too.
Oh yeah, tremendous. I mean, he's the one that got me. Down in Charlotte and with George Scott and all that. So, I mean, I'll ever be... I just brought it up the other day. I don't know why in the hell he's not in the Hall of Fame, but it certainly is something that that should be. He's not even in the WWE Hall of Fame. Wahoo McDaniels, that's hard to believe. You know what I mean? So
yeah, he was such a... he really was such a great worker and a great character in the business that... to know him was to love him.
Yeah,
fans and wrestlers always loved him.
Yeah, your dad must have died to know him because he was such an old school man. He was a him and Ray Stevens, man, two of a kind.
When I was in Japan, we first got there. Like always, you always get in the ring first time with these Japanese guys, and suddenly you find out that you should have done more cardio. And, everybody, I remember every match, one after another, every American guy that went out came back with his tongue hanging down to his feet going, holy shit, these guys they never stop.
Yeah.
And it's like, it takes a little while to get used to it and, get your cardio up for you and give the Japanese back what they deserve. And,
exactly.
Wahoo, I remember the first 2 weeks or maybe three, it was a 6 week tour. We were there and he was getting more depressed and mad and getting more fit. The first few days there, I remember he'd come back and see how stiff they were and how hard the matches were. But after about 3 weeks, I remember just Walt was just crazy on all of them. They were terrified of him. He was just going in there and just destroying them and not selling anything. He was chopping them to death.
Yeah, he was.
Every one of them. He didn't care who they were. It was Inoki or Sakaguchi or whoever it was. They were all sorry they worked with him.
Yeah.
And it was like they started it and he finished it.
Yeah. Well, his hand was thicker than a 2x4. I mean, and that chop of his, man. Jesus. Welcome to my first 10 years of my career. God, he used to beat Valentine half to death, Brett. I'm not lying. Did you ever see him work?
Oh, yeah, I saw him work.
No, the two of them. Wahoo against Valentine?
Oh, no, I never did.
The old man?
No, I never did. I never met Johnny in person.
Oh, okay. Well, Johnny was there when I started. He's in the plane crash with me. But Wahoo used to beat John Valentine. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I'm breaking into business and I'm traveling with Valentine and we're partners and all that. And he wouldn't, if you went to throw him in the ropes, he wouldn't do it. He said, "Who can throw you in the ropes in real life?" And I go, "I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Well, why are you telling me this now?" We're partners. He said, "Well, don't let him throw you in the ropes." And I said, "Well, I got to throw him in. Nelson Royal is not going to understand me saying no to him, So, Valentine, you couldn't throw him. He wouldn't go rope to rope. Did you know that?
No, but it doesn't surprise me.
No, he was like that, and he actually believed that. I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense, you know. Like, yeah. I said to everybody, now, how many clotheslines can you duck?
Right.
In transition to get to another move, right? It got 87,000 clotheslines in 3 hours of Raw that have been ducked. If you're watching the show, somebody figure out that they're going to duck under the clothesline, okay? And some of the guys that can really work do it all the time. It's, you know, to transition into another move now, right, Brett? I don't think I ever said Brett ducked the clothesline in my life, and I know Brett didn't say it to me. You know what I mean? That's the most overrated thing in the world. But Valentine, Wahoo would beat him until he was, I mean, unbelievable. And he would just fall over like a big tree. So hence, I popped on that side. I said, well, I'm just going to add a few steps to that and walk out the middle of the ring and do the same thing.
That's awesome.
And take less of the beating. Yeah, John was great, but, man, he was a different kind of guy, Brett. You wouldn't have liked him, man. He just wanted to grab a front face lock on you like Dory, but hold it on you for about 45 minutes. Till the crowd started to itch. Either they were going to leave or they were going to get mad.
Brett, just recently the WWE has announced they're going to be releasing a disc on your brother Owen, and this has excited everybody online, but maybe Martha has come out against it. Where do you stand on this? Do you think it's good that the WWE is finally doing a disc on Owen, or do you think that maybe they shouldn't have?
Oh, I think they should have a long time ago. I think that, Martha's got a very, sour sort of viewpoint on the industry, and she's entitled to that, but I don't think it's fair to sort of bury his memory, as a wrestler, or try to, see that no one ever watches his matches again, or, I think all of that's really childish and not very, it doesn't have much, that's not going to do anybody any good. She should embrace the fans that love them and the wrestlers that worked with them that love them, and the whole memory of what he was. He wasn't a businessman or a car dealer. He was a professional wrestler, and that's what he did for a living. And he made a good living at that for a long time. And he grew up in the business, and he, with a sad, tragic ending for, my family and everybody in it. But it wasn't, I don't think there's any reason to belabor the point, really, and just have bad buzz about wrestling, and that we never give the business. The business was very good to us for a long time, and what happened with Owen was just a horrible accident. And Martha, as sad as it is for the circumstances she's in, I think she's made more of an effort to see that Owen's never completely erased, or that he's forgotten front by everybody, and I see that as a real the logic of any of that.
We've got Brett the Hitman Hart with us. You can check him out online at bretthart.com or on Twitter at Brett Hart. You're listening to Woo Nation with Ric Flair. And you recently did a Twitter promotion where you ran the Citi Field account to promote an appearance there. And during that, someone asked your opinion of Hulk Hogan, and you called him a dirtbag. Do you care to elaborate?
Hey, I'm going to be at Citi Field with you. Let me hear about this.
Well, I don't have anything good to say about Hulk Hogan. I don't care to, make a big go on a big rant about the guy either. I don't. I just never found him very reliable with his integrity, and I think I can say he's somebody that made sure my career stopped, and that I never got any more. I think whatever happened to WCW was directly related to his instruction, and Bischoff was really just a mark that was playing frontman for Hogan. And it took me a little while to sort of understand that and sort of hear from people that were behind the scenes, and see how it was sort of designed for me to sit on the bench and not play a role in the show. And I thought, if you really looked at on the history side of it, that I came in with so much momentum and so much, it was like a godsend to end up in WCW. It was like so many guys I could have worked with, so many storylines, including Hogan, that would have been great, great storylines that could have done so many different things, and how Hulk Hogan sat there and just crossed my name out with a pencil every day and until my career was over. And to sort of look back on it now and go, that's okay. It's like, no, it's not okay. you know, he always pretended to be my friend. He's said a lot of questionable things about me. He's done a lot of questionable things himself. And I don't have a lot of good things to say about him. And he's never been anyone that I thought was very honest. And that's about all I have to say about him.
Well, Brett, let me just conclude this by saying, because I'm just glad that you and I are friends. I love it when you text me. And I tell you something that made my whole weekend, because it's not a lie, I've had a couple rough years out there. But when you and I and Piper and those guys were doing that little thing with Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania, I walked over to you with your wife and you said, "You look happy. You look good." And that rocked my whole weekend. I told Wendy you said that. I said, Brett looked at me and said, "You look happy and look good." I am. For the first time in a long time. And I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for the text where you told me I looked like I was getting in shape. Thanks for following my career. I hope to see you down the road. I'll see you at City Field. We'll have a good time.
Yeah, you know, I just say, you know, I've always had a lot of respect for you, and people that know me well enough know that I've always respected everything you've done for me, and everything from dropping the belt and how you treated me throughout my career. Anyway, you've always been a stand-up guy for me, and I think there's a lot of misunderstandings that sort of strained our relationship a few years ago.
Yeah, Brett, that's just people talking. You know what I mean?
Talking to each other, we sort of realized that there was a lot of smoke and no real fire, and I never had any real issues, and you never really seemed to have any issues with me. I think in retrospect now, I look back on all my matches with you with a lot of pride. I had a lot of good fun, and it was always fun working with you, and it was never a chore. It wasn't like going to Japan or anything like that. No. I loved my matches with you, and I wish we could have worked more. I wish they'd had more cameras in some of
the places. You came with WCW, bro. You came with WCW, they put you on the bench next to me.
They put me on the bench, but some of the matches that I had with you and I remember we had that Iron Man match. We had two shows that day. I think we worked Boston Garden, then we worked Worcester, and then we did an Iron Man match, and it was just such a great match. And I remember different nights, like in Germany, I spoke about, and we just tore the house down and had these phenomenal matches, and I miss them. When I look back on great matches, I have plenty of them with you, and it's a thrill being on your show here, and I appreciate the time I get when I see you and Nancy when I'm down there, or Wendy, I mean.
Well, thanks for joining us on the show today. We appreciate you being on Woo Nation. This is the Woo Nation show with Ric Flair. Brett, thanks for all the time. The best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. It was an honor, sir.
All right. Take care, guys. Talk to you soon.